After I got back from my recent vacation, I found this over here. And someone's handwriting that I recognize, but I can't place who it is, says, "I'm not lost, I'm just praying." Okay, all right. I see a lot of fingers pointing in certain directions, but so it's a long story I hear. All right, well, is it supposed to stay up here? Okay, it's down here on this little stool that Nash was just standing on. Please turn to Acts chapter 27, the second to the last chapter in this great book, A History of the Early Church. Okay, you just heard Nash read for us from Romans 1, 8 through 13, where Paul expressed by the Holy Spirit his desire to go to Rome. And he didn't want to just go to Rome, he wanted to go to the whole city that he might preach there. It was all about God's will. God, what do you want me to do? If it's your will to go there, then may I go. So Paul, are you prepared for God to answer your prayer? Now, he didn't specify how he wanted to get there. And maybe that's the way he intended it. Or maybe it never even occurred to him. I think I'm the same way. In fact, lately, because like of working on sermons like this, I think to myself, okay, you've asked for certain things, but what if God answers it not exactly in the way that you're thinking, Don? What if he gives you the end, but he gets there in a way that you didn't intend? Now, I think Paul was willing to get to Rome any way that the Lord wanted him to get there. And in this case, he's going as a prisoner. And you know the rough time he's had. And I don't see him complaining to God about it one time. I think if he had, the Spirit would have moved Luke to write that down and let us know that Paul struggled. But he just said, "God, I want to get to Rome, if by any means," that passage was saying. Did you notice that when Nash read that? If by any means, whatever God wants, I'll just leave it wide open. If he went there on a cruise ship, I think he would have been happy. If he had to go, you know, up through the land of Israel, across Asia, cross over into Europe, all on land, you know, go up through Croatia and all those areas and on up into Switzerland and then down into Italy to Rome, so be it. But that's not how he goes, either one of those things that I've just mentioned. It's a rough way that he goes. So as you observed this morning, Acts 26 shows the Roman officials deciding to send Paul to Rome because he had made that appeal to the Caesar, and so the law has to be kept. The man has to be sent there. But making an appeal to Caesar and getting to Caesar are not the same thing. You can just say it quickly in the moment like he did, but getting there will be a great struggle. All right. So when you open up Acts 27 and you read verses 1 through 3, you see how the journey to Rome begins. And they choose a centurion by the name of Julius, who's of the Augustan regiment. And he takes Paul and some other prisoners to Rome. And also, Luke informs us that he and a man from Thessalonica, I believe it was, Aristarchus, also accompany Paul, not as prisoners, but as his friends and companions, and evidently the Romans allowed that to be. And they all board a ship of Adramyttium, and they would sail along the coast of Asia, okay? So they could, I suppose, have taken a ship, either all the way to Rome or even to Crete, you know, make a couple stops, but it's that time of year where they know the weather's bad. So Paul started out in Jerusalem. He's gone down to Caesarea. Now he's going to sail up to Sidon, and then from there, they're going to go around this way from Cyprus because they want to stay close to land because of the winds and the storms that happen at this time of year. Okay, it's evidently during winter or the late fall, and they're going to go along there as I'll be pointing out to you. Okay, so verses 4 through 8 shows the troubles beginning. You know, Paul battled men, and then he has to battle the elements, battling the winds of the sea. And when you have strong waves, you have huge, or strong winds, you have huge waves, and when you have huge waves, it tosses ships around just like they're children's toys. No matter how large the ships are. I've seen videos, and you probably have too, of gigantic either ocean liners, you know, cruisers, or cargo ships, or massive military ships, you know, where they come over a wave and then they drop down and all they see is water, and they come back up and all they see is sky. No, thank you. That's not for me. And I suppose it is for some people, though. But anyways, Luke shows us the route that they took, and they used, as I already mentioned to you, they used Cyprus, that island there, as their shelter, rather than coming down south down this way. They're taking the long way, but because of the time of year, that's what they had to do. It protected them from the contrary winds. And so they went over the sea to the area by Cilicia and Pamphylia. Right here is the place where Mark left Paul and his other preaching team and kind of fell away from the faith for a while before he came back. And then God uses him to write the gospel account. So that's where they end up there. Then they're going to sail over here to this island and be there for a short time. And that's Myra, which is part of Lycia, he says. And the Roman centurion turned travel agent here found a ship from Alexandria, which is down here in Africa, that was going in the direction that they needed to go, which would be, in this case, to Crete. That's the next stop that they have to make, and they're going to use this again, this island, as a shelter from the winds that I'll talk about in just a few moments. All right, so verses 9 through 13, the danger increases. They're sailing under such conditions that it's just proving fruitless. They're not getting anywhere because they spent a lot of time doing it without making progress, and the danger just seems to increase. You know, the further they go into bad weather season, the worse it's going to get. Every hour it's getting worse. Every day it's getting worse. And then one of the prisoners spoke up, verse 10, and he said this, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end in disaster, or with disaster, and much loss not only of the cargo and ship, but also of our lives." So even the non-sailor Paul could see that they were headed for disaster, knowing that the weather's only going to get worse. It's not going to get better. And that could also lead to loss of life. However, Paul here did not sound like the typical prisoner who's only thinking of himself. Notice that he's concerned about the loss of the cargo and the ship, as well as of their lives. Not my life, he said, but of everyone. He's concerned with everything and everyone that's on board that ship, and even including the ship itself. Now, apparently the helmsman, Luke said, that would be the one who steers the ship, and the owner stated that they would continue to sail. I mean, they're not going to listen to a prisoner, especially a Jew. And if you had been a prisoner, I mean the centurion on board, where you could actually have authority over the owner of the ship and over the helmsman, who are you going to listen to? The non-experienced, non-sailor Paul, or the helmsman and the owner of the ship? Well, I would. There's no question in my mind, I'd listen to the owner of the ship. This guy knows these waters. They know what this ship can and cannot do, and they say we can go on. So on we go. And everyone else on board the ship gave their advice, and the majority thought that they should sail from there. And now they're hoping to reach a harbor on Crete called Phoenix. And you'll notice how it's open, you know, out this way. This was important to them. They needed to be able to have protection when finally it's time to leave so they could sail. All right? So in other words, not going to hit port along the top here, although it looks like there probably were some good ports, not even along this edge here, because the wind's going to be coming from this direction. So this was a perfect place for them to stop for a while. And the wind at this point is blowing gently, well, of course, because it's sheltering them from the wind. And so they believe that their plan could work, and they stayed close to Crete as they sailed. But then, verses 14 through 20, in some of our translations, we'll call it the Euroclydon. You may have something like Euroquillo, or you may even have Nor'easter. It was not long before they ran into this wild headwind, famously called as by those names that I just mentioned. It was a cyclonic, tempestuous northeast wind, which blows in the Mediterranean mostly in autumn and winter. So, did I go ahead of myself? Oh, no, I haven't. Here we go. So it's going to be coming from this direction down like this. All right. That this is going to cause a huge problem for them. And if you can imagine, once they get out into the middle of the open ocean here, where's the wind going to want to drive them? Down here. And although you look at any map, most maps don't reflect the fact that they actually started to come down here. Because Paul or Luke will mention something here that shows a danger that they were headed for, that they tried to avoid, and they did something to the ship to help it endure what they thought they were going to run into. So while they kept the shelter of an island called Clauda, I don't know if you can see it on the map there. I can see it because I'm up close, but there's a little tiny island there, and they're using that as shelter. And at this point, the skiff, which would be their rescue boat, hanging off the side, the storm is bad enough, they realize we need to get that thing on board, on the inside of the ship, lest they lose it because they may need it. So they then work to undergird the ship in case they ran aground on the Syrtis, Syrtis in the New King James, sands off the northern coast of Africa. And I looked at some satellite images, I should have put them on here so you could see them, where it shows wind blowing off of the Sahara and blowing those sands right out here into the Mediterranean, and evidently it piles up down there underneath the seafloor. And with a storm like this and everything being churned up, a ship can get caught in that. And once you're caught in that, that's it. You're shipwrecked. And the chances of dying are very strong. So the gale force storm continued, and they began to lighten the ship, throwing overboard just about everything but the food. And of course, that's going to lighten the ship so it sits up higher in the water, and you're not going to have water coming in as easily where it might help it to sink. All right, 21 through 26. Who eats during a storm like that? Most of the time, you want to avoid food because you don't want it to come right back up. So the days of the storm have increased, and so did the number of days that the people on the ship did not eat. And then this same prisoner spoke up in verse 21 and said this, "Men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship." So it's going to get rougher, but we're all going to survive. "For there stood by me this night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you.'" It almost sounds like Paul's in charge of the ship now. And he is kind of taking the leadership. A prisoner. But who is this prisoner? He's an apostle. He's an official representative of the one who makes the storms or calms the seas. Like Jesus when he's standing in the boat, when the disciples were on the Sea of Galilee, and he said, "Peace, be still." And the storm stopped. So yeah, Paul is in charge in a sense that these people on here don't understand. Verse 25, "Therefore take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island." Now, if I heard that, that would tell me, oh, we're not going to get stuck on the Syrtis sands. We're not going to be stuck on the north coast of Africa or off of the coast. But there's going to be an island someplace where we're going to be stranded for a while. So he reminds them of his earlier advice, hoping that they'll now listen to him. And he's only trying to give them hope. And actually what he's doing is he's also later preventing the Roman soldiers from killing him and the other prisoners. I don't know if he realizes that yet at this point, but he's gaining credibility in the eyes of the Roman centurion in charge of this. And you'll see what happens in just a few moments. God wanted Paul to appear before Caesar. Paul, you're going to, through this angel, he says, you're going to stand before Caesar. Therefore, you're going to survive, and God is kind enough to all the prisoners, who are, or all the passengers who are with you, the other 275 people, Paul making 276, every single one of you is going to survive, although you're going to be shipwrecked. All right. So, verses 24 or 27 through 32 really shows us that for 14 nights of this storm, can you imagine a storm lasting that long? 2 weeks? And it's so bad these people are not eating for 2 weeks. Man, what a ride. I think I'll take that roller coaster ride I took with the LTC group this year rather than something like this. Wow. So they're in the Mediterranean and the wind is just blowing them in the Adriatic Sea. You know, here's the Adriatic Sea, just all this here, just wherever it wants to go. It's in charge, kind of. But in a sense, it's blowing them closer to Rome. Otherwise, it may not have. So sometime around midnight, and it must be because they could see some light on land, the soldiers could, or the sailors could tell that they're approaching land. So they begin to take soundings, you know, bouncing sound off the bottom and timing how long it takes to come back. And the first sounding was 20 fathoms. A fathom is about 6 feet, so it's 120 feet deep at this point. They take another sounding in just a little while, now it's 15 fathoms, or 90 feet deep. So it sounds like the ocean floor is coming up. They're getting closer to land. That's good news, but it also means they might crash on some rocks. And that could be very dangerous. And they realize that. So to stop the ship, in the stern, in the back, they drop four anchors. They put down four anchors to keep them from running aground until the daylight appears where they could navigate better. However, the experienced men on board, the sailors, they believe they're not going to get out of this alive. So what they do is they pretend like they're going to let down the anchors from the prow. I guess that's the front part of the ship by the bow that's above water. They're going to let some anchors down, but really what they're doing is they're getting the skiff, and they're going to get down in it and get down into the ocean and escape and leave everybody behind. Isn't that nice to know that the people who are in charge of the vehicle that you're on are going to abandon you? Wow. But then Paul said to the Roman centurion and to the soldiers on the ship, he said, unless these men stay on the ship, you cannot be saved. So what does the Roman centurion and the soldiers do? They're now listening to Paul more than they are to the sailors, and they cut the ropes to the skiff and let it drop in the sea. 33 through 38. Here again is where you really see a prisoner taking the lead. As dawn approached, Paul spoke to everyone, imploring them to eat. A prisoner here, he's the one who's in charge. The sailors want to abandon the passengers. At one point, the sailors want to kill all the prisoners, and Paul is saying, I want to save all of you. What a difference in attitude. So he takes the leadership over the ship owner, over the helmsman, and even over the centurion. And everybody's listening to him now. For they saw his wisdom, and maybe they could tell that he was connected with the creator of raging storms and calm-filled seas. So Paul the prisoner, truly caring for everyone, says this in verse 33. And as the day was about to dawn, Luke writes, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day you have waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. Now, they're going to have to swim. Now, can you imagine swimming in a storm like that? I can't. That would be incredibly frightening and exhausting. Wow. And now you've not eaten anything for 2 weeks? So he knows what's coming. He tells everyone, you need to eat something. So he leads by example. He takes some bread right in front of everybody, then he thanks God right in front of all 275 people who are on board with him, and he begins to eat. And man, that must have looked good to everyone. And so they get encouraged, and they all start eating. And finally getting some strength. Alright, so 276 people are on this ship. That's a good sized ship. That's a lot of people. I don't know if we could put that many people in this auditorium. I mean, we probably could, but it would be really stuffed in here. And so they eat, and what do they do now? This shows you how desperate they are. They throw the rest of the food overboard. The wheat, anyways. That's a lot of weight. And, you know, it's saying that today is more important than tomorrow. We need to, why save food for tomorrow if we're going to die today? So they eat and they get rid of it. Again, lightening the ship so it'll ride higher in the water. And then 39 through 44 shows that everyone does escape. They had gone far enough off course that the sailors did not recognize the island that was before them. But they did see a bay with a beach, and they ran, planned to run. So maybe, let me see if I can take you back to a map here. Okay, so they're clear over here, evidently, to this little tiny island. Well, in their typical sailing, as businessmen, they wouldn't be stopping here. You know, they're on a ship that goes to Rome. So they're unfamiliar with this. And again, that shows just how far off course, you know, they had gone. But some good things are going to happen here that we'll see next week, Lord willing, in Acts chapter 28. And so they see this bay with a beach, and what they plan to do is to run the ship aground on the beach. So they bring the anchors up, they drop the anchors off into the sea, further again lightening the ship. They loose the rudders, believing that the wind and waves will drive them in the right direction. They pull up the mainsail and they head for land. Not anticipating that they're approaching a place where two massive bodies of water come together. And because of gravity, while the water may come together and splash up a little bit, most of it's going to be going like this, you know. And so it pulls the ship down and boom, they run aground. They're stuck. They can't get out. But behind them, the winds and the waves are just pounding the ship, beating the daylights out of it. And it starts to break up. So how frightening was that? Then, here's where the centurion's soldiers wanted to kill the prisoners, fearing that they would escape during the storm. And of course, you know, Roman soldiers were not allowed to let a prisoner escape. If they did, they paid for it with their lives. So let's just go ahead and kill these guys. That's the way they were thinking. But the centurion had grown in respect towards Paul and prevented the soldiers from their evil deed. And the centurion commanded the swimmers on board to jump in and swim to land, and the rest to find something floatable, I guess to surf to the beach. So they would grab whatever they could, and they made for land, and every single person, 276 people, swimmers and non-swimmers somehow, made it to shore during a massive storm. God's hand had to have been involved in there somehow, didn't it? Wow. All right, here's five things I think we can learn from this chapter. First of all, sometimes the experts cannot see or know everything. They may think that they can, and we may think that they can, but no one's God. Even someone who's a super expert, they've been doing something for 40, 50 or more years, and it seems like they know everything, but still there's some things they just cannot foresee. Secondly, sometimes a non-expert can see what the experts can't see. And it takes humility on both the part of the experts as well as the non-experts to recognize that fact. The expert needs to be open enough to hear what somebody is seeing that he himself can't see, but the non-expert needs to realize just because I can see something he can't right now doesn't mean I always know more than he does. And should, of course, present his information in a humble way. Number three, weather. Weather predicting has improved, there's no doubt. But they still don't always get it right, do they? And who do you, if the weather is not the way it's supposed to be tomorrow, who do you blame? You know, we all blame the weatherman. But we know, of course, it's not his fault. But one year at Klamath Falls, I can't think of what it is called right now, Snowflake Festival. And they have a snowflake parade. And the weatherman over here in Medford predicted snow for the parade, which in some ways would be a very good thing. It's called the Snowflake Festival, the Snowflake Parade, after all. So I had a friend with me and my family, and it was no snow. And there was the weather guy. I'd say his name, and you all know who he is. He's well known around here, or at least he was. I don't know if he's still on TV or not. And as he goes by, sitting on the back end of a convertible, my buddy said, "Hey, where's the snow?" And the weatherman just looked back and glared at him. You know, I thought, I bet this is not the first time he's heard that or been blamed for the weather. Number four, God delivers during the darkest moments. And we may think, well, why does he do that? Why does it have to be where a situation where I lose all hope before he jumps in there? Well, I would suggest a couple of things. First of all, it would be this, based upon Judges 7, verse 2. That's the case of Gideon. 32,000 men Gideon has. 32,000 men he has. And he's going to face off 135,000 Midianites. But Gideon's going to be the attacking force, not the defending force. And I learned during the first Persian Gulf War from General Norman Schwarzkopf that when you're the attacker, if I remember right, you need to either have 1.5 or 2.5 times the size of army than the defender does. And this time, it's not like that at all. If I remember right, the ratio was 1 to 13. For every one Israelite, there were 13 Midianites. And you remember the story, how God tells Gideon, there's too many Israelites for them, for me to deliver them, for the Midianites. Too many Israelites, God said. Why? Lest Israel become arrogant and think that they delivered themselves. So even God was thinking, okay, it's possible for 32,000 men in an attacking force to wipe out 135,000. So you know, he goes through a process to drop Gideon's numbers down to 300, which is now 450 Midianites to every Israelite. Obviously, man is not the one who wins the victory in that case. It's God. So God often gets us in a situation where we cannot help ourselves, and it's obvious that we cannot help ourselves. Then he delivers, and it's obvious that he did it. And I hear Christians all the time state something like that, that it was obviously God who did the saving here. And look at the case of Job. I mean, Job, the poor guy, lost everything. There's nothing he can do to help himself. And God lets him get as low as he can without letting him die. That's how low he gets. And then God delivers him. That's just how God does it. And he's doing it right here with Paul in Acts 27 and Acts 28. He's letting the moment get as dark as can be, as dreary as it can be, as frightening as it can be, as hopeless as it can be. That's when God jumps in. I love to read about the American Revolution because that's the same thing how it was there. I don't know if my class remembers that I taught on the first 3 months of a year. I don't remember what year it was. We were talking about America and Christianity and how here's this ragtag group of Americans. You know, some of them don't even have shoes, and they watch coming over the horizon 400 British ships, professional soldiers, cannons on their ships, and they already have men on land. And they're going to fight these guys? But they did. And in 2 days, we're going to remember the birth of our nation. Of course, we were a nation before that, but there's the actual declaration taking place there. Oh, well, I can go off on that all day long. Okay, and the final one is, listen to someone who knows God. That doesn't mean they know everything. But it does know that they know some things, and some of the things they know have to do with the one who's running this planet. They have a connection with him called prayer. He has a connection with them called his grace. I'd encourage you then, whenever you're, man, when you're down, when you're in trouble, when you don't know what to do or whatever, talk to a child of God. Just open your heart out to somebody. Call them up on the phone. Or here at services, just say, hey, can we get together this week? I got an issue that's so big, I don't know what to do. I'm at my wit's end. Can you please help me? Sure, yeah, let's get together. And you might be surprised what you'll hear. And you will be greatly blessed, I believe. So I want to offer to you right now as we sing this invitation song that if you do need the prayers of the saints tonight, you know, please don't delay. Please don't think that, well, my problem isn't that bad or I can work it out or whatever. I mean, if you need your brethren to help you, why not use them? We're all here. I suppose there's probably somebody somewhere who would say, leave me out. I don't want to be involved in anybody's life. But I think I know this congregation well enough to know that I think everyone here wants to be involved, even if it's just listening to you or offering their shoulder for you to cry upon or something. Come forward right now as we stand and sing.